Hello, this is Mike Swanson. I'm the author of the book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. In a few moments, another episode of The Great Parallax Views will begin. But before it starts, let me tell you about my book. It's available at Amazon.com, The War State. It's about how the United States became a global superpower after World War II and has brought us to this situation. Grab the book at Amazon.com after the show.
I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views. The podcast series you are about to hear befell listeners of a program known as Parallax Views, hosted and produced by J.G. Michael, who the recently arrested John McAfee once speculated was an extraterrestrial Gorgon, devised a series of episodes to be produced and published over the course of a two-week period leading up to Halloween 2020. The result of those recordings led to one of the most bizarre auditory experiences in podcasting history, the Halloween Podcast Massacre. Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. We're continuing the Halloween Podcast Massacre, but this time we've changed setting a little bit. I thought it would be apropos if we did this episode under the neon lights of an 80s-style arcade. Now, you may be thinking to yourself, an arcade? That doesn't seem like a suitably spooky setting for a Halloween-themed episode of the show. After all, arcades are where kids go to let loose, have fun, chow down on some hot dogs, and rake up high scores on the Pac-Man machine. But, as you'll learn on this edition of the program, sometimes arcades can be the perfect setting for a good scare. Especially when you're talking about a mysterious game known only as
Polybius.
That's right. Even so much as mentioning the name Polybius in a setting like this can cause a widespread panic. You see, Polybius is an alleged game that supposedly appeared briefly in arcades around Oregon before just as quickly disappearing months later. It was said to cause deleterious side effects in those who played it, including players becoming addicted to the game, becoming physically ill or sick after playing it, and, most frightening of all, incurring psychological ailments afterwards. Some even say that a few players may have taken their own lives after daring to insert a coin into the Polybius machine and enter its world. To add to the creep factor of this internet urban legend, a sort of digital campfire tale, it was alleged that Men in Black would appear at the arcades with unusual devices, testing the machine. And moreover, that the game was developed by a company known as Sinneslotion, which, from the German, would roughly translate to something like sense deletion or sensory deprivation. Very creepy, right? Well, as it turns out, there's no evidence that Polybius actually existed. But that hasn't stopped the legend of the game from capturing the imagination of our culture. It's been tied into conspiracy theories about mind control, and the CIA's MKUltra experiments has been featured on the hit TV show The Simpsons, was referenced in a Nine Inch Nails music video, and now it's even produced an actual video game for the PlayStation 4. Our guest on this edition of the program, filmmaker and author David Irons, has also allowed his imagination to run wild with the myth of this mysterious game by way of a novel aptly titled Polybius, which, using the game as a launching point, crosses the 80s teen hijinks of The Breakfast Club with the trappings of a gory 80s creature feature horror movie to give a thrill ride of a read. In this conversation, David and I talk about the novel, 80s horror movies, nostalgia and retro aesthetics, and even his thoughts on the hit novel, now a major motion picture directed by Steven Spielberg, Ready Player One. All that and more on this edition of Parallax Views, and now on to the conversation with David Irons, author of Polybius. Welcome to Parallax Views. David Irons, author of the new book. I just finished reading it this morning. Polybius. How are you doing, David Irons?
I'm doing very well, thank you very much. I just want to say thank you for having me on the show. I really appreciate it.
Well, I'm glad to have had you on. I always like discovering new authors, especially in the horror genre, which listeners will know that I love very much. And I have a lot of listeners that are very excited about this episode because everyone loves this urban legend of Polybius. And I guess we should start with that. For listeners that don't know, what is the urban legend of Polybius? It's sort of a digital campfire story at this point.
Yeah, it really is. It's something that kind of popped up. Well, it first popped up on coinop.org in the early 2000s. I think it was 2003. And it was just a screenshot and a quick rundown of a video game named Polybius. And no one's kind of come forward and said where the screenshot come from. No one says said anything about where the game, this basic information about the game had come from. It just appeared on a database of video games. And it kind of generated from there what this thing is. It's kind of twisted through time into being, like you're saying, like a digital campfire tale. And it's gone from this mystery game into stories of like Men in Black turning up at an arcade in Portland, Oregon, and tampering with this weird black video arcade machine, the Polybius machine with one joystick and one button that's apparently cause seizures and nausea and brainwashed people. And it's turned into this, and it's something that keeps on going today with more information turning up here and there. And yeah, it's part creepypasta, part urban legend. It's an interesting thing that keeps growing, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you know that you've kind of become a part of pop culture when you're featured in an episode of The Simpsons. You know, the previous game shows up in The Simpsons. So it's definitely part of pop culture at this point. What I find really interesting, though, is that this, I would say, I don't think the Polybius arcade game was real. I don't think we have that much evidence for it, although now there actually are Polybius games, right? They have one for the PlayStation 4 now, apparently. But what's interesting is, as a sort of creepypasta or urban legend, it's not a very detailed story. It's basically, oh, there was this game that showed up in Portland, and people got sick, and there were men in black. And really, it's a creepypasta where people that read it or learn about it, they sort of have to fill in all the blanks. And supposedly, it's in Portland for, 2 months, and then it disappears, which in a way makes it the perfect material for a book, right? Because, you know, most of the story is left to the imagination.
Well, this is exactly how I felt about the whole thing. It was kind of like, it felt, before I even approached the book and I started hearing about the legend, it felt like, imagine if the novel of Frankenstein had never been written. It just didn't exist. But you were in a room full of people and they were going, yeah, there's this great story, have you heard about it? And there was like a flash of lightning and this guy made up of body parts and the lightning hit him and brought him back to life, and there's a mad doctor and the creature runs around the town. And I was just hearing all this stuff and like looking around at everyone thinking, why hasn't anyone told this story yet? And that was kind of the impetus of how it got turned into a novel, because it was so, there was so much there, but it was so open. You could take all this stuff and just create something with it. And that's kind of how it started. It was definitely that. There was definitely the idea there of like, there's so much here to do with this. You could really turn it into something. And one of the things, tonally, how this book plays, and something that played into this, was my girlfriend likes, she likes paranormal horror films. She likes, I don't know if you've ever seen the TV movie, The Haunted, from the early 90s. It was on Fox. It was like a Fox TV movie. Have you ever seen that one?
You know, I'm familiar with it, but I thought, you know, the first thing I thought, since I know you're from the United Kingdom, I thought you were going to mention Ghost Watch.
Well, yeah, do you know what? That had the desired effect on me, that Ghost Watch. It really did. That was, I saw that when I was very young. I saw it on that airing, the notorious Awesome World type airing, when it just blew everyone's mind. And it blew my mind as well. I think I was like 10 at the time, 12, something like that when I saw it. And that definitely worked. Everyone believed that at the time, 100%.
Yeah, it was presented sort of as a documentary for my listeners that are unfamiliar. But The Haunted, actually, I don't think I've seen it, but I know about it.
Well, that film, that's the kind of film that my girlfriend really likes. She likes The Haunted is one of her favorite films, ghost films. She likes The Entity and Poltergeist and things like that. And I'm more of like 80s slasher, 80s trash, anything kind of 80s sleazy. That's my kind of stuff. And I always try and introduce her to new things, like, you need to watch this. And she says, no, I really don't need to watch that. And I was like, you do need to watch this. Trust me, you do. And we sat down to watch Return of the Living Dead. And it was the tone of the book kind of came from her watching Return of the Living Dead, because I've seen it so many times. I know when to laugh. I know when to feel the horror on the screen. I really know that film very well. And being with someone who's just watching it for the first time, it was like all those emotions from the first time I watched it came back again. And when it started with like Bert and Ernie in the morgue and the factory at the beginning and everything, she's looking at me going, this is just one of those silly films, isn't it? This is just one of those silly films. This is just some sort of silly. I'm just carry on watching it. And by the time you got to the bit where they've got the corpse tied down on the gurney, and it's, what is it saying? I feel pain and all that business. It hurts to be dead and all those things. She was looking at me saying, this is absolutely terrifying. And that kind of leads into how I write a horror novel. I do it with a full sense of security and a crocodile grin. It's like, yeah, this is all fine, but something might happen. Something might happen, then something happens. And you kind of, you kind of get that feeling of like, oh, this is fine. I know what this is. And something really hits home. And you're like, oh, my God, Jesus. Yeah, this is terrible. And her feelings watching this kind of bled into the way I write and also bled into this idea of Polybius about, okay, what about if we take this idea about, oh, it's a killer arcade machine. And then we just plant that idea where it's kids having a Halloween party at an arcade and then turn it into, okay, everyone's trapped in the arcade. And then it becomes the Breakfast Club meets Night of the Living Dead. So you got all those team problems caught in this one place with this arcade machine that's possessing people, if you will, and mutating them in like some weird Cronenbergian way. So that was my thinking of it, how I could take this story that's quite open to interpretation and turn it into this thing. It was definitely that. It was that. And you had, like, in the 70s, you had Spielberg made Jaws, and then Roger Corman made Piranha. And my thinking was this, was like, okay, Spielberg's made Ready Player One, so I'm going to do the Corman version of that, and it's going to be Polybius.
Yeah, it's interesting you mention horror comedy, because in a lot of ways, I think my favorite horror movies usually are a mix of horror and comedy, and they're usually from the 80s. We'll get into the 80s element of the book. But Return of the Living Dead, a lot of the Joe Dante-type movies, The Howling, instance, is definitely in the category of mixing horror and some really dark horror. I mean, this is a film that had, you know, a snuff film subplot, and along with comedic moments. A movie like Piranha, when I was a kid and I saw that, there's funny bits in it, but there were parts that I was like, oh, that's so creepy. It's the piranhas are going to get the kids. There is something about mixing the comedic with the horrific that really works. I think when you have a comedic moment, it sort of makes you let your guard down. And then when something horrific happens, it's even more horrific because you weren't expecting it.
Yeah, completely. That's when you can really hit home. And I think that the secret to this is, if you take two films that are recent, I can't even think of the guy's name. Who directed Get Out and Us? I can't think of the guy's name off the top of my head. Who directed those two films? It's the comedian guy.
Oh, Jordan Peele.
Jordan Peele, yeah. The two Jordan Peele films. I was thinking, because I know he's a comic as well, isn't he? He does comedy stuff, yeah. The two Jordan Peele films, if you look, and this is a good way to say how to mix horror and comedy. And in Get Out, you have the main plot, and that's like the, you know, taking over guys' bodies and the brainwashing and everything else, and that's deadly serious. And then you have the comedy relief, the guy that's kind of taken out of it. Like the horror isn't mixed with the comedy immediately in the same scene. But then in Us, it's the opposite. And they have people reacting in comedy ways to horror situations. And I think that's what really breaks it. I think the horror's got to be horror and the comedy has to be comedy. Because in Return of the Living Dead, there's a couple of scenes where you mix it and it works, but it's not a constant thing. It's just like I was saying, the horrifying things are horrifying things and the funny things are funny things. And Return of the Living Dead does it quite well because it can do it sometimes in the same scenes. I love, like, there's a part of the beginning when they think they know the rules about how to kill a zombie, and they're holding the guy down on the floor and they put the pickaxe through the back of his head, and it's like, the brains! I hit the fucking brain! And that kind of stuff, which is, that to me, that's hilarious. That you can do it in bits, but it's just like, I mean, I don't know how you feel about Return of the Living Dead 2, but that's just like, it's too silly in a way to be taken serious with any kind of threat.
You know what's funny? I don't remember a lot from Return of the Living Dead 2. I remember the gag about the James Karen and Tom Matthew characters saying repeatedly throughout the movie, this feels like it's really familiar, because they were in the first one is basically the same characters. I remember that, and I also remember out of nowhere a Michael Jackson zombie showing up. And that's all I remember from Return of the Living Dead Part 2.
No, I think that's all you need to remember from Return of the Living Dead Part 2. It's just that everything's a gag, everything's silly, and nothing's played anywhere near serious. No one acts seriously in that film, like there's a real threat coming for them. But in the first one, you really feel it. It's like, oh my God, these things are outside. They're trying to get into the morgue. We need to nail up the doors. It does everything a zombie film should do, and the humor's kind of added in around it. And it's the silliness doesn't meet together like it does in Return of the Living Dead 2, which doesn't, as a film, I just don't think it works. I think it's just too silly for its own good. It's kind of like, it should be like PG-13, that film. It should be like a kid's zombie film, because it kind of feels that way. You've got the kid characters in there, and the comedy's silly. You can't take it seriously, really, as a zombie film. You feel no threat with it. And I think that's the fine line, really. And I think Joe Dante knows that. Apart from Gremlins 2, which is all out just slapstick mania, I think he knows how to do it, like you were saying, with The Howling. And I think parts of The Burbs as well. I think there's parts of The Burbs. The family are always creepy. They're never silly. Like that. The people around it are silly, but the family are terrible. Like if they moved in anywhere, anyone would find them terrifying. It works in that way.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mentioned The Howling in particular because I think that's one of those movies that if you just turn it on and you're not watching it that closely, you sort of see it as a straight horror film. But if you're watching it closely, there's a lot of these comedic twists. Another movie that I feel like that is it's more of an overt comedy, but I think a young person watching would find it scary. Is a movie like The Texas Chainsaw Massacre Part 2, which, is very over the top and very comedic. But there's also some moments that are just like, wow, this is like really crazy and gory and like kind of icky. And it sort of hits both spots in a way that a lot of these movies that try to mix horror and comedy don't always hit the mark on.
No, I think Texas Chainsaw 2 is kind of Texas Chainsaw 2 is really a product of his editing, because if you took a bit more of the comedy out of it, it would have been this super gory, horrific horror film. And if you took more of the gore out, it would have been a comedy. And the way they kind of balanced it is you've got equal lashings of everything. And with the gore, I've seen an interview with Tom Savini, and when he's talking about the bit at the beginning with the two, the yuppies in the car, and the guy gets his head chainsawed off. He's always said they just left that camera too long on that the gore effect. When you see that, the reverse shot of the head and the blood coming out in the hand, and it's like they do leave on it too long. And you can see it's an effect, and I get what he's saying on that. But it does feel they want everything in that film. It doesn't feel like it was. I mean, you look at the first one, and I think the first one is a piece of art. I really do. I think it's absolute pure terror, that film. It does something that no other film really has before. I really think it catches a kind of a mania in it with everything, especially with Sally at the end. And the second one, I think the second one wants everything. It wants the mania, it wants the craziness, it wants the blood the first one didn't have, but it also wants to be funny. And I think Texas Chainsaw 2 could be one of the most quotable horror films around, to be honest.
I'm the Lord of the Harvest. I love Dennis Hopper in that.
It was amazing. Absolutely amazing. And he didn't want to do it, did he? He didn't want to do it. It was his comeback film. It was his last chance. Because he was just wrecked for so many other films like previous. But he's so good in it. He's so funny in it. It's, I love it. Personally, I really like it. I know this is a bit of a hot take, but I think Texas Chainsaw, even The Next Generation, I think that one's kind of, it's okay.
Can I be honest with you? I will be even more controversial. Texas Chainsaw The Next Generation is my favorite of the sequels.
Well, this is where we can probably be the best of friends for the rest of our lives. Because I genuinely really like that film. I can see its problems. I look at it and I know. I mean, no one actually gets killed with a chainsaw. No one gets killed with a chainsaw. Not one person gets killed with a chainsaw in it. But I love the tone of the film. I love the soundtrack to the film. I love the look of the film. Matthew McConaughey is amazing in that film. When people say Matthew McConaughey, I just think of that film immediately. And I think the problem with it, weirdly enough, and it's written by the guy who did the co-wrote the first one, I think it's the script. I think there's parts of that script where just like, what the hell is going on? What is happening here? And the one thing that I can never justify is that Matthew McConaughey is chasing the guy in the wrecker and he's running down the side of the road. And he just, and he's going to kill, he's seen he's killed people. He's seen like corpses. And like, they broke a kid's neck in front of him, didn't they? And he pulls up next to this kid who he's chasing. And he's like, are you scared yet, boy? And the kid turns around and says, please, sir, you're really scaring me. It's like, these don't sound like human beings. It just sounds like aliens have been beamed down to write a script. No one talks about this. Like, what the hell is this? Who says, please, sir? You're scaring me. You just run. You didn't even stop to give him like 5 seconds of time to say a word. You just keep going. It's crazy. But I do, I know it's fruit, but I do honestly like Pixar. I kind of skip from 1 to 4. And then 2 and 3 are bonus movies for me in a way. And the rest of them, the remake's okay. And the rest of them beyond that pretty much don't exist.
I mean, I could talk about Texas Chainsaw for hours, but I want to take it back to Polybius in this sense. Maybe without giving away too much of the plot, maybe you could tell my listeners a little bit about the characters you play with. You play with a lot of different types of characters. So there's the punk rock girl, the nerd, the girl that you think is just sort of, the sexy, naive girl, but really she's kind of a badass. The sleazy arcade owner. Give an insight into the type of characters in this story.
Yeah, well, the best way to describe it really is I always like just say when you watch the Friday the 13th or something like that, and you'd see the you'd latch onto a character with say Corey Feldman or Crispin Glover, and you think, oh yeah, you'd like that kind of character. Like I like that character in this film. And you don't ever really get to explore them in a horror film. You get, 90 minutes and they die. And so with a book, you can really kind of take those kind of cliche characters you see in a film and just pad out a backstory for them and make them real. Just give them more time in a novel than you could a film. And I approach it, I mean, that you could say they're cliche characters, but they've definitely been injected with more life than you'd see in a film. They're given more depth. And that's what I like about the novel.
I was going to say, you do give a lot of time for character development. I did feel a sort of connection with these characters, even if they are, they do have cliched elements. They are kind of...
You could stand back and you could say you could stand back and say the nerd, the jock, the girl, the bitch, the everything. Like what you'd see in an 80s high school film. You could, it's in there. But it is, like I was saying, you do, they are larger than life, but there is more to them, than on the surface. And it's funny you mentioned that because, I remember actually, and if you go back and you read the book, every character I kind of gave a secret to, all the main characters, and I thought that was probably the best way to approach this when you're dealing with something that's a secret, like the game is a secret. We don't know if it existed, if it did exist, what did it do, did they really do this? And I kind of treat every character like that. And if you think back, like the arc of the character, how they start, and something that has happened or is happening in their lives, other people don't know about. By the time they get into the arcade and everything goes to hell and this machine starts warping everyone's minds, bodies and souls, they change. They turn from one thing to another. So there was one point in time when I was writing the first draft. I was like, if all else fails and like this doesn't end up being a Polybius book, I'm just going to call it Secret because it would work. Like everyone's got a secret in this book. Yeah, just give it a whole element and just turn it into a teen drama called Secret, because it would work.
Yeah, I was going to add to that. Each character sort of has, well, a sort of mystery side to him. The girl that works at the arcade, Sophie, has a hidden sort of side to her and a hidden past. The love interest of the main character, Matthew, Kara. She has her own sort of hidden story, and you see glimpses of it, and you really build up to, well, what's going on with this character? What's in their past that is bothering them in a way that you don't see in a lot of these horror novels today? And that sort of brings me to another point I wanted to make. You know, with a lot of these novels or movies or TV series today that are genre related, even something I like, for instance, like the I enjoyed the Twilight Zone remake series for what it was, but there was this obsession with putting Easter eggs in it. And all these TV shows and movies now have to have Easter eggs. And I mean, I think there's a few in Polybius, but it doesn't bog itself down in this whole, oh, it's like an Easter egg hunt. You have to, you know, catch every reference we make to some obscure bit of trivia from pop culture.
Yeah, I mean, I try to mix in any kind of references literally with the prose rather than, I don't know if you've ever heard, have you ever heard the supercut of the audiobook of Ready Player One? Have you ever heard this before or not?
No, I haven't, but I wanted to talk about Ready Player One with you, actually.
Yeah, no, but they did a supercut of the Ready Player One audiobook. And it was like, I think the audiobook's like 6 hours or something. And this supercut's like an hour of just saying things that, nostalgia buttons, just things that exist. Ghostbusters, G.I. Joe, Mask, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Nightmare on Elm Street, War Games. And it's just literally an hour's worth of that book is just listing other things, which I was shocked when I heard that. And consciously, I mean, there is some of these, they do go for it, a lot of these 80s novels, where, like, 80s novels written now, like the modern 80s novel, if you will, they do try and do, just jump on the soldier train and just talk about things. And I don't want to start listing things. I just feel like sometimes you're reading, like, a kid's wish list from a Sears catalogue. Like, okay, I want this, okay, yeah, get it, all these things, yeah, I know these things. Everyone knows these things from the 80s. And I wanted to try and mix in any references, because it's a video game book. So I just wanted to try and give the prose that more of that, just mix in the references with the prose. And there's a scene at the beginning of the book where the mum, Matthew's mum and sister, are arguing. And it was like, you know, the comments of going backwards and forwards like a game of Pong and stuff like that. It just things I could mix in there naturally rather than forcing references in. So that was something conscious that I did do with the whole thing, to be fair. And I think it makes it for a more authentic experience, you know. Like most of the novels that I've got out there are retro novels. They're set in the past. And, you know, like if you was going to pick up a Stephen King book from the 80s or a Clive Barker book or something, you wouldn't pick up something that's just listing the things in the now. And I try not to do that when I write a retro novel because it just doesn't feel authentic.
You know, it's interesting. I want to get into the Ready Player One thing and maybe your thoughts on Ready Player One and why Polybius is sort of the antidote to Ready Player One and some of the problems of Ready Player One. But I have to ask first. If there was one Easter egg that I did notice, and maybe I'm misinterpreting this, you had a character that showed up for just like less than like a paragraph, Mrs. Blankenship. And I thought to myself, is that a Halloween 6 Curse of Michael Myers reference?
I applaud you for that. I applaud you for noticing that. It really is.
Well, I didn't know. I was like, that could be a common name. I don't know.
No, it's really not. It really is. That's exactly what it came from. Yeah, it was Halloween 6. Yep, that's it. You got it.
See, but it's not one of those distracting Easter eggs. You know, you don't need to know that to be into the book.
No, completely not. And just before we started talking, I was just going over my new book. It's gone to the editor and I've got some revisions back. And I was just going over everything, giving it a final draft. And it's funny you say that. Again, you drop something in there, which some people might notice and some people might not know this, and one of the descriptions in the new book was the rain was coming down, hitting the window screen like the blades of 1,000 maniacs. And my editor actually put a little note on there going, oh, nice reference. to say, yes, it just feels like a more authentic way to do it, just to put something in there, just quick, like that. There's a few people like yourself who'd pick up on it, like, oh, yeah, I know where that came from. It's fine.
So in regards to Ready Player One, I read a print interview. What was your reaction to Ready Player One for my listening audience? And why is Polybius, your book, sort of like the, I don't know, it's like the gritty, like what Ready Player One could have been if it had more edge to it?
It's exactly, just like I've said before, it's, you know, if Spielberg made Jaws, Corman made Piranha, Spielberg made Ready Player One, and this is that if in this in another world, Corman made Polybius, definitely. I really didn't like that novel. I really didn't like it. I heard so much hype about it, and I was thinking, oh, it just sounds like the sort of thing that I would like. Do you know what I mean? I think it, like most people, my kind of age, would think, oh yeah, this sounds great. On paper, it's great. But when you actually listen to the thing, like I say, an hour's worth of this just references is unbelievable. And there's no real story there. It's just an Easter egg. Literally, the Easter egg hunt is the story. I read this thing and the book was like, okay, I get it. And I wasn't impressed. And then the film, there was just so many dopey things. They've taken this thing, which was pretty empty anyway, and then Hollywood came along and injected it with even more Hollywood emptiness. And the whole thing, when it was like the love interest, oh, he's going to meet the love interest. And, oh, you know, like there's going to be this big thing about, oh, no, she's got a scar on her face. And if you look at that girl in the film, and it's just like, you know, like everyone's acting like she's got leprosy. It's just like, oh, yeah, that poor girl. And it's like she's got like a bit of red makeup on her face. It's just like, this is insane. What is this world you've created? Like, I don't understand. She looks absolutely fine to me. I'd date that girl. There's no problem. And everyone's just, oh, no, terrible, terrible. Get away. Put a mask, put a bag on her head and send her to the corner. We can't look at this hideous being. If they made her look like Freddy Krueger, and that would have been kind of interesting. Okay, guy turns up to meet the girl he's liked online for all this time and she looks like Freddy. Oh, yeah, sorry, I'm a burns victim. I'm a pizza face now. Oh, okay. Like, the reaction would have been justified for that. But that wasn't what we got. It was just that Hollywood thing. Oh, we can't make her too unattractive because this is a Hollywood film. Oh, okay. And it just felt like something made by a committee. Like, oh, yeah. How far should the scar go on this? And a bunch of people talking nonsense to one another decided on nothing that would actually work on screen. It just felt like that to me. It just felt cheap. It just... Like you say, like, I mean, kudos to Spielberg for making that thing because he saw that and I read in an interview that he kind of goes to things in popular culture to make a film about. But I want to make a film about this because I feel right now this should be the right thing to make a film about because it's going to be popular. And in a way, like, the whole nostalgia thing is popular. I mean, you've got Stranger Things and Glow and all these shows around at the moment. So he did tap into something which is the now, the nostalgia for 30 years ago now, but I just don't think it works as a film. It's just so shallow and vapid, and the book's even more shallow and vapid. I'll stand by that forever. It's kind of an insult. I went into I know exactly what print interview you're talking about, and I went into a bookstore, and it was there was the shelf, and it was like, oh, the literary greats of science fiction, and you had Harlan Ellison, Philip K. Dick, and I can swear on this, can't I?
Yes, no problem.
Perfect. Fucking Ready Player One was up there next to these guys. And it's just like, are you kidding me? Is this the world I've fallen into where this is cast in the same shadow of a literary great? There it is. The Ready Player. And I was like, no, no, no. And yeah, that scene came off that shelf. And I took it off the shelf and chucked it under another shelf. My way, so no one could see it. I was like, it just doesn't deserve to be there. It just doesn't deserve to be there. That's not right. It's really not.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned the popularity of Stranger Things, because I wanted to get into this idea of, you know, the retro novel or like the 80s sort of novel. And a lot of your work has this 80s nostalgia to it. Is there any particular reason you're drawn to the 80s? Did you grow up back then? What's the appeal?
There's actually, it's gonna kind of come full circle with Return of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, this answer, and that's the fact. That's quite funny. But if you look at things in the '80s, there was definitely like this obsession with the '50s. There's this 30-year gap of like guys growing up and they look back to the past. I mean, like in the '80s, you got Back to the Future. Even something like Saved by the Bell's got that kind of like 50s kind of vibe to it. Do you know what I mean?
I was going to say some of my favorite 80s horror movies are actually sort of riffing and parodying those 50s horror movies. Yeah. One of my favorites is the Tom Atkins starring Night of the Creeps. Which is very much based in the 50s.
You read my mind. You really read my mind. That's brilliant. Yeah, that's great.
But yeah, go on with this 80s, 50s sort of...
No, I will do it. Yeah, no worries. It's that was really bizarre because I was literally just about to say Night of the Creeps. Honestly, I was just thinking about the black and white segment at the beginning. That's brilliant. That was my go-to. That was both of our go-tos. There you go. There is. There's this 30-year thing when you kind of, you know, if guys grow up, they want to make films and they look back to a point in time that was important to them. And in the '80s, you had the '50s. And now it's that same kind of thing. And the thing that kind of ruined movies for a very long time, and the movie itself's not bad. It's absolutely fine, but it's Titanic because it was this 2-hour overblown thing that kind of broke the convention of having a simple 90-minute movie. Everything had to be big and epic and long and shot a certain way. And it kind of poisoned. I mean, look at the Star Wars prequels after that. It kind of poisoned them, didn't it? They were like two and a half hours long and all this business. And these great maraudering plots about nothing because it's just been stretched to oblivion. And I ever was a fan of those movies in the 80s that you go to a video store, you pick something up, you put it in a machine, you could watch it for an hour and a half and you get a fully formed story. I felt completely satisfied by it. And I like that kind of storytelling. I like the aesthetics. So something from the 80s, something I really remember fondly as a kid. I was really young, probably about 7 or 8, something like that. And I went to like a shopping mall with my sister and we walked into this clothes shop and everything was blue neon steel. And I just stood there and even as a kid, I just felt this is a real moment in time. It's just like, I like this and I don't want it to change. Like it felt cool, it looked cool, I loved it. And then everything changed and you went into the '90s and the grunge look and everything just turned dreary, like '70s kind of dreary again. But I didn't like that. And I didn't like some of the films, like I say, in the mid '90s to the early 2000s that were coming out. They didn't really appeal to me. And I started making stuff, because originally I'm a filmmaker. And when I started making things, I'd make things look old, like I'd want to do things retro, like 80s or whatever it was. The first thing I made was the black and white thing, and it looked like something from the 50s. I wanted to make something that looked like something, like it looked like a film. And I think like Quentin Tarantino in a way does that. You look at his stuff and everything he makes feels like a film. It's been inspired by other films. It has a film feel to it. It doesn't try and be modern about things. It just takes place in its own film world. And there was when I started writing, because when you write, whatever's inside you comes out. Whatever is in your soul comes out on that page, and you start putting things down, and that's part of you. It's just like, I know why I wrote this, because I like these things. And the 80s, the retro stuff started coming out, and I was like, okay, but this is where this is all going to go. Like, I'm thinking about the films I liked and the books I liked from that time. And I thought, like, what? I can't do every book as a retro book set in the 80s. It's just ridiculous. I can't do everything. But I was like, I knew in my heart I wanted to do quite a lot of them. And there was a review in Fangoria of when Texas Chainsaw Massacre, The Next Generation, came out. And the quote in the review was, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, The Next Generation seems to be stuck in its own 70s bubble. It doesn't seem to have evolved with time. And that always stuck with me. And when I started writing, I was like, well, you know, everyone's got their thing when they're writing. Like, this is my, you know, like their kind of like genre or style. And I thought, even if I'm not writing things set in the 80s, I'm going to write things in that kind of style. I'm going to use that. This is going to be my bubble. I'm going to take that 80s stuff and put it in my bubble and produce stuff, whether it be films, whether it be books, that has that feel to it. You can get a good story in 200 pages, or you can get a good film in 90 minutes. It's just, it's a compact thing, that kind of compact storytelling that you got from that time. And that's kind of how it progressed from there. And it's to something I think about today. And even like what we said about dialogue, and building character, it's, I kind of go back to those things from that time to inject those, kind of, things needed to build a character as how you would do it then rather than how you do it now. I think some of the things now, I don't want to get political or anything like that, but I think there's some real silliness when it comes to like making a character now, where people just have people virtual signal and stuff like that, and it just becomes this weird. Well, you're not really a character. You just, you know, someone's just tagged some things they thought had some depth onto what you're saying, but you're still not really a character. That doesn't make a character. And there's whole characters and things that just have that, like, you know, just walking around telling other people how bad they are and how good they are.
I want to give an example of that. And, you know, it's not even that I disagreed with, like, maybe some of the, you know, political ideas in it. But, like, the Black Christmas remake that came out a year ago, I just thought, you know, and I get that it's, like, meant for teeny boppers. It's not really meant for someone in their late 20s, right? Maybe it's for a different generation. And I get that it's also sort of satirical in a way, but it was just so in your face about its message. And even if you agree or disagree with the message, just the way it beats you over the head with it, to me, was so unnecessary. Whereas in the original film, there is sort of a feminist message to it, because the final girl, of course, is the girl that's like, you know, I'm not having the baby. And it is like sort of subversive for its time. But the new one just was completely, you know, trying to play off the culture wars of today in a way that is so in your face as to make it almost obnoxious.
Yeah, I completely agree. But I mean, the difference about these two things is it's just the way, I mean, like the way things are marketed. I mean, like when Black Christmas came out in the 70s, I'm damn sure the ad campaign wasn't, this film stars all women. It's about all women. Look at this film about all women. No, it was a film and the characters in it were women, and it felt accepted. Like, it was fine. It was like, okay, I'm going to watch this thing, and it's about girls and a sorority house and a killer. It's fine. It was what it should be. It felt fine. But then with this new thing, it takes the things that the old thing did, and it's about girls on a sorority house, and he just wears it on his sleeve like it's just done the most amazing thing ever. Groundbreaking. Look, this is about women in the sorority house. Did I mention women and women? Well, that's what the old one was about. There's nothing new there. There's nothing new. It's just highlighting things that were already there and then putting a badge on them and going, look what we've done. Isn't it majestic? It's like, well, no. It was already in the original one. And the horror genres, I mean, there's a great book called Men, Women and Chainsaws. And that's basically a lot to do with like feminism in horror films. And then when you start deconstructing a lot of these horror films, it's a really female populated genre. It really is. It's just by nature. It is. I'm not saying I agree with this, but Brian De Palma once said, you know, I find it far more terrifying to see a woman running away in terror than it is a man running away in terror. And I kind of get what he's saying in that. But then it's subverting your expectations already a horror film, because 99% of these things with a woman running around in terror, they turn around and fight back. And it is about women fighting for survival and, you know, fighting against this menace by nature. So it kind of just feels odd that someone would point out, you know, look at Nancy in Nightmare on Elm Street. She's a prime example. She's, you know, you don't say it was about this girl fighting this dirty old man. And no, she was just a really good character. And it worked. You didn't have to point out all these odd things, like political things. It's buzzwords to try and make people think, oh, yeah, this is a very important film.
Well, this is also true. Not to interrupt you, but this is also true of the nostalgia thing, right? Because so Tarantino and Rodriguez come out with Grindhouse, and then all these filmmakers are like, oh, I'm going to make a tribute film to the Grindhouse movies, and we'll just put film grain in it, and then it'll be like a Grindhouse movie. And I feel like that also happens with, like, 80s nostalgia flicks in a different way, where, A, they try too hard, and B, it just comes off as obnoxious. And this book doesn't really do that. Were you consciously trying to avoid that?
Completely, yeah. And I know exactly what you're talking about. There's things that come out now. It's bizarre, because, you know, I've still got my toes in the film world for certain things. And I hear of things, and people say, this is going to be a really 80s film. And they go, oh, okay. And you read the script, and there's like, okay, well, there's nothing 80s in this. And then you start seeing how they're putting stuff together pre-production. It's like, yeah, we're totally going to have a neon light in this film. And it's like, oh, okay, yeah, I get it. It's that kind of, it's like that real surface level. I'm just going to do something that I've seen in one of these films and add something in there. And I think that's exactly the same as what you're saying about the kind of fake grindhouse films that came out. I mean, that just died a death immediately. And I'm glad it did, because it was just ridiculous. The stuff that was coming out, and it's just like, hey, but it, in a way, it kind of cheapens. You don't have to try as a filmmaker, should I say. You don't have to try. Because a lot of people look back at the grindhouse stuff as they do the 80s stuff, and they look at it and go, oh, well, it was cheesy, and it sucked, and it was crap, and the acting was bad, and the sound was bad, and the editing was bad, and the special effects were corny. So you were going to make a film like that. And I think that's bled over to the 80s stuff, where you see all these kind of, like, fake, facts, 80s action films, and everyone acts like a douchebag in them. And it's just like guys getting shot a million times, they're not getting hit and just walking out and blowing people away, and it's corny, and it's cheesy. And it's a surface-level idea of what those things were. And I think that's what people are doing with the 80s stuff, as they did with the grindhouse stuff. It's not genuinely a product. It's not something that emulates a product of that time. This doesn't feel like a film that would come out in the 70s or 80s. If someone's looked at something and said, oh, well, that sucks, I can make something that sucks, and they think they're being intelligent or inventive or creative making something that isn't very good, and they know it's not very good, and I don't know if they're capable of making anything good, but they've made something at a level where they've got this denial, where it's like if someone turns around and says, well, this is shit, it's always supposed to be, it's an 80s thing. All those things are shit, don't you remember? And the 70s stuff. But I think that's part of it. It's kind of a get-out-of-jail-free card where you can make something bad and say, oh, it's supposed to be bad.
It's interesting you mentioned the levels thing because, I mean, this book, this novel, Polybius, really does sort of play out like a video game. There's, you know, it feels like you're advancing through different levels. The chapters are very short and punchy. They sort of get to that compact point. It is like a 90-minute 80s horror movie, and I'm curious, you take it in a completely different direction than the urban legend by adding, without spoiling things, this element of sci-fi monsters. It's almost like a mix between Tron and the zombie genre. How did you decide to do that?
It was, see, the difficult thing was, and I don't know if you picked up on this when you read the book, but I never described once what the game's like. I never describe what the game is on the screen. You get an idea of what the game is. And I didn't want to, I thought it was just being too specific to turn around and say, okay, it's like a Pac-Man clone, or it's a Space Invaders clone, or it's a Mappy clone, or it's a Phoenix clone. It looks like something like this. I just wanted it to be this thing as we know it. And I didn't want to solve the mystery of what Polybius is. I didn't want to say what Polybius is this. So I needed to have it as a mystery. And no one's ever complained and said, well, you never tell us really what the arcade machine is. Because I added that whole other level on top of it. It's like, as you're going close to this machine, then something starts happening to you. And the characters in the book, they're getting closer to it. And this thing starts transforming them into, you know, like you said, some kind of Tron, Cronenbergian body horror type situation. It turns you into something else. And it kind of distracts from the thing you want to know with another problem, which the characters have to solve. And it just kind of brings a more interesting horror element to it. I cannot really remember how I came up with those actual creatures for this book. I just knew that I needed more than was in the original. Like we say, the original story was open to interpretation. And I thought this would be, it being a horror novel, the next best place to go and kind of give it some kind of pseudoscience why this thing was actually happening that way and have fun with it rather than get bogged down with trying to explain what the game is, if you look at a lot of the stuff that's already out there, like the media, like there's lots of films, fan films and things people make about Polybius. They're all set from the point of view of now. The game existed. There was this game, and we're going to find the game, and weird stuff's going to happen around the game. And that wasn't... It's just like, well, everyone's done this. What's the opposite of this? The birth of the game. What was the legend in Portland, Oregon in 1981? And I had so much leeway, I could turn it into anything. And that's kind of what I did with what people become with the creatures.
Well, the story is really... It's not so much about what was this game Polybius. It's about, okay, if there was a game called Polybius, what would be the reason that no one in Portland, Oregon knows about it? Where are the people who knew about the game? And that's what the book sort of answers.
Yeah, the book is the creation of the legend. Mm-hmm. And I turned it into an entertaining 90-minute horror film.
You know what? In that regard, once you actually get into the arcade and the action starts really picking up in an insane way, it really started to feel like an 80s horror movie. And I started getting pictures in my head of very specific 80s horror movies while reading it. You know, the Sophie character, when she sort of goes full badass, I was thinking to myself, oh, it's like Linnea Quigley's spider character in Sorority Babes in the Slimeball Bullerama. And then the other movie that I kept thinking about, I was like, was he influenced at all by Jim Wynorski's Chopping Mall?
Of course, everything above, all those things are in my head as things I love, and they come out onto the page. This is exactly what I was talking about, like this bubble, like, okay, that Texas Chainsaw review about, this film stuck in a 1970s bubble. And the way I write these things, I'm stuck in this 1980s bubble. And all of these things that you're talking about, like Slimeball Babes and everything else, Chopping Mall, it's all there. It's in my mind as I'm writing this thing. And
it's not done in a way where you're like, I'm going to name a character Spider, like in Sorority Babes. It's done in this way of, you know, those movies were set in these compact mall-like settings, like an arcade, and you sort of get the atmosphere rather than trying to go for cheap in-jokes and references.
Yeah, well, that's the problem. They're exactly that, just cheap in-jokes and references. It's just what I can't... I've seen films padded with those things. Just it's. I mean, we were getting those. I mean, look at Night of the Creeps. I mean, to a degree, there was in-jokes there, but you really had to be in on the joke. Like all the characters' names of horror directors, like a normal guy on the street could watch Night of the Creeps and never pick up all of those names of the horror directors.
Yeah, I was going to say, Fred Decker in Night of the Creeps, he did he was doing Easter eggs before we called him Easter eggs.
Yeah. No, he really was. But the thing is what he did there, everything was just, it wasn't based around the Easter eggs. And I think a lot of things now are literally based around the Easter eggs. It's, you know, like, oh, guess what, everyone? We've got a Walkman in this scene. Oh, guess what, everyone? We've got a Rubik's Cube in this scene. Remember those? And it does get a bit like that. There's certain things I watch and it's like, oh, just, I can't get it. I get it. This is, we're set in the 80s. This is why you're doing this, because everyone remembers this thing that you used to like. There it is. It's jangling in front of you like a bunch of keys in front of a cat's face. Look at it. Oh, you love it. You love it. And it just gets silly. But like, I think if you can do things with some sort of sincerity and make, like, I feel from what you're saying to me now, it's like, I feel like I've succeeded in bringing that spirit and that atmosphere from those films that influenced me and kind of regurgitate them and turn them into something new, where you can see, oh yeah, it's kind of like that, it's kind of like this, but I haven't got characters named Spider. I haven't got, the guy that owns the mall isn't, the arcade isn't called Fred Decker. You know what I mean? There's nothing silly in there like that.
You know, another interesting thing that happened while I was reading the book, as I really got into it, I started envisioning the characters if they were played by actors from an 80s movie. You know, for instance, yeah. I kept picturing Linnea Quigley, who I actually just interviewed, as the Sophie character. And then you have the evil German, Steve Rusch. And I just thought, my God, that would – Klaus Kinski. It has to be Klaus Kinski. did you have any, like, mind's eye sort of ideas about, like, who would play these characters maybe if this were an 80s movie?
I did, yeah. Like, my actual pick in my mind for Sophie, the change booth girl, was Barbara Crampton. That in my head. And I was thinking, if I ever get around to doing an audiobook version of this, she'd be the perfect person to read this audiobook. That'd be awesome. Definitely Barbara Crampton. Who else was there who I was thinking of when I was doing this? It was kind of like people we would obviously know from liking horror, like Nightmare on Elm Street 2, Mark Patton. There was like, I can't think of the guy's name as the bully. There's like you think of the bullies in the book, and it was like, oh yeah, that guy. In my mind's eye, it's like, oh yeah, that douchebag from like Friday the 13th, part 5. That guy would be the guy that puts on Tommy's mask in Friday the 13th, part 5, and he comes through the door, and he's like, what's the matter, Chief? Can I take a joke?
Right, right, and then Tommy gives him the, you know, wrestling move, F5 off his shoulders.
Yeah, like power slams him through a desk or something. And it was just like, guys, I think in my mind, I was like, yeah, he would be Nick. If we were casting this in 1985, he would be Nick. And there were certain people I'd go through, like, as I was doing it, but definitely Barbara Crampton, definitely that guy's Nick from Friday the 13th, 5. I can't think of his name off the top of my head. There was just various like horror people, you know, that you see and you remember from these things. But yeah, there was the process. I mean, I can't, for this book, I can't really remember, but who I picked in my mind's eye. But there was a time when I wrote another book called Night Creepers, and for that, I literally cut actors' IMDb photos out and just laid them all out, and it was like, these are my characters, and this is how we're going to do this. And going back to Halloween 6 again, it was the... Do you remember the mum with the glasses in Halloween 6?
Yes, Kim Darby, who is actually also in one of my favorite TV movies, Don't Be Afraid of the Dark, yeah.
Yeah. She was one of the protagonists in that. I was like, I want someone different, I want someone quirky. Okay, yeah, we're going to use her. And I had her picture stuck on the wall for like 6 months while I wrote this novel, just had it up there, and then put other people around are like, yeah, this is the cast I would have if this was a film that I would have made in the late 80s, early 90s with that one. I mean, that book is a modern day book, but I still used that kind of 80s, 90-minute film philosophy on that, and I took these actors from that kind of time period and just put them all together and was like, well, this is my cast, and this is what I'm going to do with them. So yeah, it's definitely something I think of, but the only problem is I'm a very fast writer. I am quick at getting these things done. I like to move on to something else, then come back and revisit, and then polish it again, and just polish it to the best of my ability that moment in time, and finish it. Just get it done. That's done. This is the book I wrote in 2013, 2014, whatever. So I probably should save some of this stuff, because I do these, you know, like if I make any charts of actor faces on the stuff to refer back to, it's something I definitely think about, 100%.
I was going to say, I have to stick on this one point. The evil German sort of antagonist, who would you cast as him? Because like I said, I was thinking, you know, maybe a Klaus Kinski, maybe a Richard Lynch, maybe Donald Pleasence if he could pull off the... German accent. Who would you cast as Steve Rusch?
I do remember this, actually. In my mind's eye, Billy Mitchell. I really was just like, if you could give Billy Mitchell a German accent, he's perfect. You know Billy Mitchell from King of Kong? The guy with the high score for King Donkey Kong? Do you know this guy?
Yes, yeah, now I do. Yeah.
Yeah, like, it's just like the ultimate douchebag. Just have to get that guy. Give that guy a German accent. And I've been walking around like, my arcade game is the best arcade game ever. It's just like, yeah, you'd fucking hate him. Just look at this guy. And it's like, yeah. I mean, Billy Mitchell is basically a villain. Let's be serious. Like, look at the guy. He's perfect. Absolutely perfect. Like, that's what I saw in my mind's eye. Someone who thinks he's something so special, and anyone with any sense can look at them and just think they're a douchebag. Definitely.
Did you have a lot of fun with that character? Because, like, you know, it's such an over-the-top character. Like, the evil German bad guy, mystery man, man in black type character is so common. But I think you were having a lot of fun with that character. And even though he only pops up really sporadically in the book, he has some real key scenes where you're like, wow, what an asshole. And they're really memorable scenes as well.
I don't want to spoil anything, but I know exactly something in the back of the ambulance, I think we might be thinking about here.
There's also the rooftop scene, but...
The rooftop scene is very much an asshole in that one. Yeah, I agree, 100%. Yeah, I did. It was that thing again, though. It was, you know, if you had him popping up all the way through it, I mean, how much of a character can you really write like that before it's ridiculous? Because he is like, you know, your quintessential 80s quote unquote foreign bad guy, like something from a Die Hard film, you know, it's that kind of thing. And if you have too much of that, it becomes comical. I mean, look at Die Hard, Alan Rickman in Die Hard. He's, you know, he's in a handful of scenes all the way through it, and it works. But if you had to focus on him all the time, I just don't think, you know, it would work, because you can kind of see how goofy he is. And there were moments in Die Hard where Rickman is quite goofy with certain things. And I kind of took that thinking to this character, you know. I just wanted to enjoy. I wanted to enjoy him in the parts where he should enjoy him, and he should do the things he should do in that scene. But I think too much of him, and you can. I think he becomes paper thin in a way. I think you can just see right through it. It feels like less of a threat. The more mystery you give a guy like that, the better it is, because you don't really know what he's thinking and how far he's going to go. And you could kind of say what happens on the rooftop is kind of similar in a way to what happens in the scene in Die Hard, when he's got the guy and he's saying to him, you know the codes, so just give the codes. And it's that kind of thing. It's almost a warning shot for the audience or the reader, like, oh, this guy seems like that, but he does mean business. Like, don't fuck with this guy. So I did kind of take those elements of character, how you'd see in these things, and kind of inject. I mean, you look at a lot of these things. Look at Cobra, that the Stallone film. You don't really spend that much time with the bad guy in it, but you know through the things that he does, it's like, Jesus Christ, yeah, this guy really means business. And you never really get to know him, but so I was just kind of taking that with a bit. So more, less is more sometimes, definitely.
There were just a few more things I wanted to touch upon briefly, if you have the time. I guess the first thing is there is a lot of gore in this book. And I'm just wondering, so as a writer, how do you come up with gory scenes and decapitation and, you know, horrible acts of violence for a book? Because, you know, with a movie, you can portray it visually. But how do you come up with that in your head and then get it down in the page in a way that will be cinematic for the reader who can imagine it?
See, the thing is, what I always try and do is just add something. Just to say, for example, Friday the 13th, Part 6, there's lots of visual puns in that, like the whole American Express card, don't leave home without it, kind of things that pop out on these gore scenes that make them work in a different way, that make them more fun. Like, a few people have said to me, it's like, yeah, you write fun horror novels. They're fun to read, but when they want to be horror, they want to be horror. And when they want to be fun, they want to be fun. And it's almost kind of like a Tales from the Crypt kind of feel to certain things. And when it comes to those gore scenes, I definitely try and add things in there where it's like that, almost like a juxtaposition between light and dark. Well, I try and make things feel funny. Then you hit them again with that punch. And there's, I'll tell you something I'm working on right now. The next book coming out is called My Ouija Boyfriend, about a girl who starts a relationship with something she starts talking to with a Ouija board. And there's a scene in there where let's just say, for argument's sake, a demon, a spirit, a supernatural spirit's been harassing this girl. It makes her believe that it's God. God's talking to me, it's God. And I just try and add humour to all these things that happen. So it tells her to do all these awful things, and she ends up decapitating her mother on a car bonnet, and the police turn up, and it's just like, what the hell, you know, did you, what the hell's going on? And she turns around to them and says, God told me to, at least that's what I think he said. And then she gets, things happen, and she dies, and she falls off of a bridge, hits the floor, looks up, and it's described in the book as there's a car rolling towards her, and the bumper sticker says, honk if you love Jesus. And the car just flattens her, goes straight over her. And then the final line of the chapter is, she splattered for Jesus. And it's just like, you don't have to describe every bit of bone and skull, and you can. But it's just adding something to it, like a sense of humor to it, or that gives it that kind of edge sometimes, like, ooh, that's really nasty. And I find that works. I do. Just having that, like that Friday the 13th, 6 kind of sense of humor. You add these little things in there specific to those characters, to the gore. And when you get to know these people, you know, it's kind of, it makes their deaths even more personal. So you can add and splash as much of the red stuff around as you can. But these little bits you add in there just kind of, I don't know, add thorns to it, you know?
So another thing I wanted to ask you about was, and, you know, I've heard some authors say this, other authors say, oh, that's just the crap that pretentious people give you. But there's always this question of, when you're writing a novel and you get invested in these characters that you create, do you ever feel bad when you have to eventually kill them off?
There was the first novel that I wrote, which was the first novel that I had published, should I say, was Nightwave. And I don't care when it comes to killing characters. I really don't. I'm just like, okay, your time's up. Here we go. Time to clock in or clock out, or you're gone. You're finished. And it was the readers. When they read that book, there was a character in Nightwave called Mickey, and he was basically like a young guy who was hanging around with these girls to fight basically parasitic sea sirens. They got these parasite sea sirens, and he's helping these girls fight them. And then towards the end, there's a chapter, and he gets caught and killed. And everyone with that book turned around and said, I can't believe he killed him. Can't believe he killed him. And personally, I didn't feel... I was like, well, it's his time. Clock him out. He's done. He's finished. Get rid of this guy. His time's up. But so many people have said, oh, you really shouldn't have killed him. You shouldn't have killed him. And it makes me think more now about that when I'm writing things, about do I really want to kill this character in this way right now? Or if this character, you know, rather than dying, maybe they just lose a hand and come back at the end. And I'm very cautious about like how people feel with these characters. But I don't have a problem killing them, not at all. But I do understand from that experience why people do want to see certain people alive, like the attachment they get to them. You spend a lot of your life sitting down and writing a book and reading a book are completely two different things. Like, you sit there and I get so much fun and enjoyment out of writing horror. I really do. I sit there and it's like, oh, it's kind of, I'm kind of like the older brother who's tormenting his sister. And like I said, this whole thing about the full sense of security I like to give people with these things. It's like, oh, everything's fine. Come along. It's really fine. And then it's just like, haha, it's not going to be fine. Look at this. Something awful's happened. His eyeballs have been poked out and his skull's just exploded out the top of his head like a giant zit. And I get to that point, and it's just, for me, it's like a joke. It's just like, you weren't expecting that, and then you've seen something or read something that's completely awful. And it makes for a good shock effect. It really does. And that's, I get a good kick out of that. I do. But then there's the other side of it. Like, as a writer, I do that. But as a reader, it's like that does make a big impact when you've spent so much time with these characters. I mean, like, I know where the story's going to go, and I'm leading up to the punchline. Like, yeah, this guy's going to, like I was telling you about the Ouija thing, this girl thinks she's talking to God is going to get splattered by a truck with a honk if you love Jesus bumper sticker on her. That for me is the it's like a joke. It's like I'm telling a joke in a way with gore added to it. But as for the reader, they might not necessarily see it like that as they're reading this thing along and following the character. They're not in on the joke like me, so it's a completely different set of things as you're doing it.
Well, you know, at least you haven't had a reader that ends up being like the Kathy Bates character in Misery that's like, you can't end it that way! And she's like, takes you hostage and breaks your legs. Oh my god.
Not yet. Hopefully that won't happen. But if it did happen, I can't even make a good book out of it because it's already been done. So hopefully that won't happen at all. We can, just write that one off the list completely.
I will say this. I did sort of develop a little bit. I mean, I get that the characters are over the top in your book, Polybius, but I did sort of develop an attachment to them in this, like, I mean, let's be honest. The Breakfast Club, the characters are pretty over-the-top caricatures, but you do develop a sort of connection with them, right? And I got that out of this book, too. There were characters that I was like, oh, no, he can't make them go that way. And then you do, but I don't know. I think it works in a way because it packs a little bit of a punch.
Yeah, I think it does. I think it does. I mean, talking about characters who I felt something for, I don't want to say, like, to ruin the book, but, like, let's just say the fate of Sophie the Changeproof Girl. I like that character. I like her because it's that whole thing, isn't it? It's just like you see one thing, but she's really doing something else. And you get to a point where, I'm just going to say, you'll know what I'm talking about, but when she's trapped later in the book and you kind of get a backstory to why she's not the thing you think she is, that changed three times. Because I liked her. I just really liked the character. There was something about her that just was plugged in for me.
I felt that way as well reading the book, and I also was satisfied that you went in a different direction with her, even in the end, that I didn't expect.
Yeah, definitely. Because she kind of changes three ways. She becomes three. She's three things in this book, and she starts out as just Sophie the Changeproof Girl, and then she kind of turns into something from a Tarantino film, and then she kind of turns into a human being. And you see why she is the other two things at the beginning. And the reasons why I gave her, why she changed, I mean, the first one, even when I did the first draft, and I gave the first draft to my editor, she turned around and said, like, this is really good, but it's not this book. And it wasn't that book. It's not. And I took this whole chapter about why she did this and just saved it. I was like, I'm just going to save that for something else. And then the next one came along, the next version, and it was just like, yeah, you're giving... It's like we can tell you love this character and you want to have this payoff, but it's just too much again. It's like, yeah, I know what you mean. And then I kind of went for, I'm going to say it's almost kind of like, her backstory is almost like a Linda Blair film. Do you know what I mean? Like it's like a 42nd Street Linda Blair film with a heart.
Savage Streets.
With what happens to her. Exactly. Exactly that. Yeah. Exactly that. It's Savage Streets. In a way, it has that kind of thing. It's like you feel that heartbreak in Savage Streets when certain things happen in it. Like where like they set it up, like it's kind of hammy in a way, but they set that whole thing up with that poor girl who's pregnant and she's going to leave and get married and have the wonderful life ever. And then some fucking guy just picks her up over his head and throws her off of a bridge. And you just, it's this heartbreak. So I can't believe you did that to that girl. Cause there's all these things that lead up and it's like, she was such a nice person. And she had such a nice life ahead of her, and you just threw her off of a bridge. And it was. I had to get to my Savage Streets throwing off a bridge moment to make everything else that you'd seen about this character, which wasn't exactly the nicest of things, more credible. So, yeah, that it was definitely close to the change of this girl. That changed a lot.
You know, it's interesting in that regard. I just want to add this, and then we'll start wrapping, is, you know, I think for me... The characters that stood out the most, And I'm assuming this wasn't by accident, was Sophie, who you mentioned, Kara, who's running around in the Elvira suit and is sort of a love interest to the nerdy main character. And the other one that stood out is the sister of the main character, Elizabeth. Mm. And I think it's interesting because now maybe I'm reading it wrong, but I just found myself way more invested in a lot of the female characters. I felt like there was more to them. There was a more emotional side, because I'm a sucker for, you know, the emotional side of characters. And I felt like it really does have sort of an interest in the female characters. Do you enjoy writing female characters maybe a little bit more than the male characters at times?
Yeah, I definitely do. Yeah, you've definitely picked up on something there. It's just something. I mean, as I grew up, I had three sisters, so I can probably relate more to women in that way. I'm not saying that, you know, I don't get on with guys or anything like that. It's just that's not true. But I think there's certain things that one of my sisters kind of fed into in my life, and like when. Like I say, she's 10 years older than me, so she was a teenager in the 80s. And she used to be like a lead singer in this heavy metal band, and she used to drive around in a big black car, and she had this attitude, and as a kid, I was like, oh my fucking God, like, when I grow up, I want to be just like you. Like, everything you do is amazing. And I used to hang out with her quite a lot. She was always, you know, just used to, oh yeah, come in my bedroom and listen to this Iron Maiden LP or Van Halen LP and that kind of thing. And I know that kind of her character definitely bleeds into things that I do. And I've always just been, I think because of her, and growing up in that situation, it kind of, lent me towards strong female characters in the past and things that I used to watch. I mean, I kind of got, you know, fair weather friend kind of attitude to Doctor Who. Like, I've never been a great Doctor Who fan or anything. Like, I know what it is, and I know certain things I like about it. I'm more of a horror guy than a sci-fi guy, definitely. But in the seventh Doctor, used to have Ace with him as a companion. I don't know if you know anything about her whatsoever, but she was, like, the one companion used to walk around with, like, a black bomber jacket covered in patches of a baseball bat, a bazooka. And, like, it just made sense to me. It's like you're going to fight Daleks and you'd see, like, the other companions from the past and they'd just run around screaming. And this girl would, if she did something which was common sense, okay, well, there's some, like, alien robot, so I'm going to go out there with a bazooka and a baseball bat and kill the fucking thing. Yeah, that makes complete sense to me. And so through time, there were certain female characters that just stuck in my mind. Like, yeah, she was really cool. I liked that. And it fed into the sister thing. And I think that comes through sometimes. When I'm writing these novels, what I really do is just there's elements of my past, think people I've liked in entertainment, and my sister that appear in this, in the novels that I write and the films I make. You know?
I think there's strength in your female characters too, but they're not. It's not like done in this way where it's like the Ripley clone from the Alien movies, right? Like, it's not.
Yeah.
They're very human, and I actually really appreciate that, because I think in general too, women characters in film and books, I think a lot of times they can just be more interesting because, you know, as men, we're sort of taught that we have to be stoic with our, like, emotions. I think a lot of men even don't like to be in touch with their emotions. It's almost like a thing we're taught to be afraid of at times. And I think as a result, women are sort of allowed to express a wider band of emotions, which just makes them more interesting subjects within a piece of literature or film. And I like how you don't just masculinize your female characters.
No, I think that's, I mean, back in, like, I went to film school. I'm back in film school. One of the subjects or whatever we had to do, one of the courses within going to film school, was you had to pick certain subjects, and one of the options was feminist film. and this is going back like 15 years ago now, and I was like, 100%, I'm going to go and do that. Like, that's absolutely fine. I get that. I understand. It's, you know, I'm a horror guy. Everything I watch is predominantly females running around trying to kill something that's trying to kill them. Right, okay, feminist film, let's go for it. And they started off with, okay, I can't even think back to the first film that we watched, because we definitely watched Aliens, and then we definitely watched something else after that, which was quite similar. It could have even been T2. It could have been something like that. Then they took the leap, and they said, oh, yeah, next week is a feminist film. We're going to watch Tomb Raider. And I laughed, and I was like, are you fucking kidding me? Like, Tomb Raider, just because it's got a woman in it, Tomb Raider couldn't be considered I just can't consider that as a feminist film. It's just like, it just doesn't make sense in my mind. It's like, realistically, what is Lara Croft? She's just like a great big pair of boobs with a great big pair of gums and a British accent and some innuendos. It's just like, I don't see that as even being a character. It's just like a really bad caricature. And that, I was like, yeah, I don't really agree with this. This is, I think it's just bullshit. Just like, fucking ridiculous. Hi, boys, check out my big gums. Okay, yeah, we get it, Lara. Right. We get it.
Well, the thing is, in that regard, I think usually, like, there's the trap of, you know, we're going to portray the female heroine as, like, you know, the sex object, the sex bomb, yeah, like a Lara Croft. And then on the other hand, you have the sort of Ripley character. And I like Ripley from Alien, right?
But yeah, I do.
The thing is, Ripley is really, like, very masculinized, especially in the sequels, in a way that I think does a disservice to, like, her being a fully human character. For, well, a better example of this is the Night of the Living Dead remake that Tom Savini directed, which I like. People have said, oh, that's so great. She's such a badass. Barbara is such a badass in this movie as opposed to in the original, where she was just scared. And I'm like, she's being attacked by zombies in the original. It makes sense for her to be scared. Like, maybe sometimes, you know, even a powerful woman is scared. That, you know, it doesn't have to be one or the other.
Yeah, I was on the set. I want to go back and say something, guys, quickly about the film class. They actually said after Tomb Raider, they said, well, the fourth feminist film on this, what we're going to be watching, is Resident Evil. I was just like, are you fucking kidding me? It's just that that film is, you couldn't even consider Alice human. She's like a mannequin. There's nothing human about it. She's superhuman in everything she does. And she has no emotion to anything that was happening. That she doesn't scream. She shows no fear. It's just constantly, oh, I can do this. It's a killer dog jumping at me. I'll karate kick it. It's fine. And that gets progressively worse through the series. I just completely went off on one then. What was we talking? We were talking Night of the Living Dead.
Well, I was just saying that. So I like the Night of the Living Dead.
Oh, no, sorry.
I like how in the remake, she's a badass, but at the same time, she's a badass with no vulnerabilities, you know? And I think the vulnerabilities that the original Barbara had in the original film, that could have been served well in the remake. Because I think a character that has no vulnerabilities, okay, you can say that's a feminist character, but I think it's not human. Like, a human character can be a badass, but also have vulnerabilities in them as well. And I think, in a way, it's not feminist if you have a character that isn't fully human, that's just a sort of masculinized, badass version of a female.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And one of the most bizarre decisions that I've ever seen, I was on a film set, and a close friend of mine was in this film. I don't want to give too much away in case the person who directed it is listening to it. But they made a decision which I found absolutely bonkers. And that was, there was a creature coming after the protagonist, who was female, and they said, don't scream. And I was like, okay, this is going to be very interesting, how you're going to get a performance out of this thing. was not screaming, because it was literally the classic, it's coming down the stairs, you're trying to get out the door, you have to run off because it's coming near the door, and you run into the living room, and you're going for the phone, and the phone doesn't work, and it's right behind you, and then it corners you, and it's getting closer. And sometimes cliches and are there for a reason. You know, these things happen for a reason, and it's because it works. And I think in that moment, if something was coming after you, you're either going to be, oh my fucking God, holy shit, or you're going to be screaming. You've got to show some sort of reaction to it. Something, you're feeling something, and you've got to show something to the audience so they can feel something. And this decision was made, no screaming when this thing's coming for you. And the actress was like lost in a way, like, I feel I should be screaming. No, no, we don't want you to scream. Well, what can I do? Well, you can whimper. You can kind of show frustration because this thing's coming for you, but you can't scream. So all these scenes were shot, and I was thinking, okay, so you don't scream when it's coming for you at the door. You don't scream when it's coming for you when you're on the phone. You do scream when you're cornered and it's coming in on you. You're showing some kind of emotion. You're making some kind of noise. And they didn't do this. They didn't. There was no screaming. This thing came closer and closer, and then the thing happened that stopped the monster. And it ended. And when you saw this thing cut together, it just felt flat, because you needed that script. You needed to feel that. You needed to feel the terror and see the terror of someone screaming, showing reaction. Someone's showing a reaction to this thing coming closer and closer so you could feel it. And when it wasn't there, the whole scene felt lacking. It genuinely felt lacking. It just felt so odd. It was, and then once you had this thing and you were cutting it and you were putting a soundtrack to it, and you felt instinctively that you need a scream. There should be screaming at this. This is a horror film, and you feel you should have that satisfaction of watching that and feeling that emotion of fear through this person who's on the screen that you're watching, and it's just not there. It was a very bizarre choice.
And that doesn't mean a strong female character, like,
no. It means being fucking human.
If
and someone come creeping behind you and you felt a pair of hands just, you know, slowly moving around your neck as we're having this conversation, you'd scream. If so, I'm sitting here now in a loft and I can see the loft hatch, and if someone walked up those steps and I can just see a black silhouette walking up there, I'd probably scream. People scream. It doesn't matter about your gender. Like, fear is fear. And that's, you know, that's horror.
And that's also, I think, what is really an asset to Polybius, is that you do have strong female characters, but they also do get scared at times, which is human. And the Mills character, the Mill characters also show fear at times. Oh, who would have thunk it? And I think that is what makes Polybius just a really fun ride. I want to wrap up here by giving you the floor to let my listeners know how they can read your work. And what's your last pitch for Polybius, if people want to read it? Or how would you sell someone on it?
I would sell someone on Polybius saying, if you want to see Night of the Living Dead crossed with The Breakfast Club set in an 80s arcade on Halloween, then Polybius is the book for you. So go out and buy a copy now. And you can find me on Amazon, where all my books are. Just type in David Irons to the search bar and it'll come up. And I've also got a shop on Etsy where I sell signed copies of my books. And you can find me on Twitter at David Irons 79, on Instagram at David Irons Writer, and just type my name to Facebook and I'll be on there.
I want to thank you again, David Irons, for coming on Parallax Views. And you know what,
pleasure.
Listeners, if you have a chance, read this book on Halloween night. It's really worth reading. Thank you again, David Irons.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. We are continuing the countdown to Halloween, and we are only just a few short days away. I hope you've been enjoying the Halloween podcast massacre so far, and that you liked my conversation with David Irons, author of Polybius, which I highly recommend picking up and reading. As always, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at ParallaxViewsPod@protonmail.com. Producers credit shoutouts to Amelia, Mark, Martin, Brace, John, Ted, Zach, Gratz, Mickey, and Chase. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, well, then consider joining those listeners in supporting me at the $10 or $15 tiers of my Patreon page at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said,